Hello, you're listening to On the Point, the news collective show formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland right here on CATR 101.9 FM. I'm Isaac Yu.
I'm Maddie Delplane.
I'm Grace Jenkins.
And I'm Akshay Kulkarni. It's Saturday, March 27th. We're broadcasting remotely nowadays, but we're based on UBC's Vancouver campus, on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
This week, we're talking to Mel Woods, former associate editor of Huffington Post Canada, about what the recent shutdown of HuffPost says about the media environment in Canada and the implications for local journalism.
We also discuss the escalating COVID-19 situation in BC, as Dr. Bonnie Henry confirms we're in the midst of the third wave of this pandemic. But first, Isa, can you tell us about your interview with Mel Woods?
So I spoke to Mel Woods about the shutting down of HuffPost Canada, which was announced in early March, resulting in layoffs of 23 workers. This had happened after the purchase by BuzzFeed, who had also announced layoffs for the U.S. newsroom on Tuesday. Mel gave me a behind-the-scenes look at the reality of the media landscape in Canada, which is relevant because, you know, we're all student journalists here, but also because local news is valuable to the population at large for addressing news that's undercovered by larger outlets.
All right. Sounds bad. Let's take a listen.
To start, can you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Yeah. So my name is Mel Woods, and I'm a former associate editor at HuffPost Canada. So now I'm just a freelance writer and audio producer based in Vancouver.
Could you please tell us about how you found yourself at HuffPost and walk us through what happened a few weeks ago?
Definitely. So I graduated from the University of British Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism in 2019 and was kind of immediately hired into HuffPost, first as a medical leave contract. So I was there for 8 months. And then my contract got extended and extended and extended, basically up until we were all fired a couple weeks ago. And my role there, I largely wrote about kind of internet trends, viral stories, and Western Canadian news. I was the only person based west of Toronto during my time there. As for what happened a couple weeks ago, HuffPost Canada was acquired by BuzzFeed. The sale was announced in November, and it was finalized in mid-February. These things happen, you know, media companies buy media companies. And when BuzzFeed announced that they were acquiring HuffPost, they did indicate that there was going to be some degree of what they called streamlining. They'd be kind of assessing all the different HuffPost assets. You know, HuffPost is an international company. There's outlets in, you know, France, Australia, Japan, et cetera. And when they announced the deal in November, they actually immediately shut down HuffPost Brazil and HuffPost India. So it definitely was like an indication to us that potentially we might be on the chopping block. But I think the exact timing and how it happened was a surprise to everybody, including our managers. Not a single person actually working in Canada knew it was going to happen. And so on Tuesday, a couple weeks ago, we were called for a meeting with the BuzzFeed executives, all of HuffPost, not just HuffPost Canada. And we didn't know what this meeting was about. We thought it actually might be some good news that they might have been hiring a new editor in chief for us. The password to this meeting was "Spring is here." And there's like some jazzy fun music at the start of it. And first they told us that there would be a series of layoffs at HuffPost US, then a series of layoffs at HuffPost UK. And then the third item on the list was that they were shutting down HuffPost Canada and HuffPost Quebec immediately. And so that left, we had about two dozen journalists working here in Canada, and all of us were kind of immediately out of a job as of that day. They shut down our website that day, and everything kind of happened very, very quickly from there.
So what do you think the shutdown of HuffPost Canada says about the media and journalism industry here in Canada?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, a few years back when HuffPost first expanded into Canada, and by a few years, I guess 10 years ago, when HuffPost Canada kind of first launched, was right around when BuzzFeed was really launching into Canada, when Vice was launching into Canada. And I think there was a lot of talk that maybe that would be the future for Canada, would be these kind of arms of US outlets opening offices here and being able to, you know, report on Canadian issues and stuff, but still have the backing of this big international corporation. And we've seen over the past decade that that's kind of declined a bit. You know, Vice has pulled back a lot of their Canadian operations and more integrated them into a general international operation. BuzzFeed Canada doesn't really even have an office here. And there's like, you know, there's a few people who are BuzzFeed Canada, but they largely report to folks in the States. And now we see HuffPost Canada closing. So that probably isn't the future of media, that strategy. And I think that HuffPost Canada is also a big loss in a broad sense, because we kind of did a certain type of reporting and covered certain communities that the mainstream media largely did not. And as a mainstream outlet with kind of mainstream backing, we, you know, we were able to elevate a lot of stories of queer folks and racially diverse communities and sex workers. And, you know, we did a lot of reporting that you won't see in like Post Media or The Star and stuff like that. So I think there's a big loss to Canadian journalism with that being gone. I mean, you know, us, the people who were doing those stories, we're still here and we'll be taking those stories to other outlets and stuff. But I think what HuffPost really represented as a progressive space for those kinds of voices is really a big loss.
So what do we lose when we lose coverage of issues specific to Western Canada, i.e. your beat at HuffPost?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because I think that Canadian media is really centralized to Toronto. And I, you know, now that I'm back on the market and in the job search, I definitely have noticed that there's a lot of jobs, but they're in Toronto. And I think that's, you know, I'm from Alberta originally. I think even, you know, Vancouver's got it pretty okay. Like, we're very lucky out here to have, you know, startups that have really settled in and done well, like the Tai is a great example of that, of doing some like local reporting. And, you know, the Capital Daily in Victoria and the new Fraser Valley Current that's launching. I think the Vancouver area has some stuff figured out when it comes to the future of like local news and whatnot. I'm from Alberta and I reported a lot on Alberta during my time at HuffPost. And I think the prairies and the middle of Canada gets forgotten so often and gets forgotten in coverage. And when you have, you know, like I mentioned, like BuzzFeed and Vice still have people here, none of those people are really outside of Toronto for a huge amount. Like, they're bits and pieces everywhere, but everything still ends up being centralized to Toronto. And so we lose out on a lot of coverage and it's really left to the CBC to do. I mean, there's like local, there's your Post Media papers and things like that. But I think, you know, local news in Western Canada is really covered by the CBC. And that's not necessarily a good thing. There needs to be more of it. And so I think like, you know, locally funded startups and stuff. I point to like the Sprawl in Calgary are the future for local news. I don't know how much, you know, what I was doing contributes to that, because it obviously isn't a viable business model based on the fact that we got closed. So I was in a really unique situation with what I was doing. And it is hard when I'm looking and being like, I want to do a job like that again. Like, I loved my job and I was good at it and it was fun. That those jobs don't exist, and that's frustrating. And maybe they do and I just haven't found them yet, or I need to make them for myself, but it'll be interesting to see what happens.
So following that line of thought, can you give us some reasons why local journalism is important in this time?
Oh yeah, it's so important, right? Like, it's, you know, accountability of, you know, politicians is a huge one, you know, at the local level, the provincial level, and the federal level. And it's important to serve communities. I think journalism is all about service. And at the end of the day, like, local service is the very baseline of that. It's like, yeah, what the federal government is doing is important and relevant to me, but also like what's happening with bike lanes in my community is also important to me. And I didn't get to cover a ton of that stuff with HuffPost because a huge amount of our readership is in Ontario. And so a lot of work I was doing was contextualizing stuff that was happening in Western Canada for an Ontario audience and saying like, you should be paying attention to this thing. And so I think more local news means more people saying you should be paying attention to this thing. And getting elevated beyond just the local communities there, while also serving people who live in those communities.
So as someone who's actually a journalist, what do you think about the phrase, journalism is a dying industry, or media is a dying industry?
I mean, I think that it's not. It's an increasingly casualized industry, which is a bad thing when you come from a labor perspective and you think about, like, I was a contract worker at HuffPost, which meant I didn't get benefits and I will not be getting severance right now. And that's a problem because I was laid off and I should be getting severance. But that's because I was a contract worker and that's like a precarious thing. And so many media jobs are that. And that's why you see a lot of people leaving journalism at a certain point because they need stability. But at the same time, that means that anybody can be a journalist and do journalism. And I think that that is a really valuable thing, to be able to have people who aren't quote unquote journalists doing journalism, because anybody can do journalism. It's about reporting on your communities and telling the stories of your communities. And I think that there's space to expand that definition and let people who you wouldn't traditionally think of being like a, you know, news hound with a fedora and a little notepad. It's like journalism is a lot of different things. And I hope that our definition of journalism expands and shifts and changes, because I think that's what it has to do to keep up for the future.
Yeah, so in that case, what can people do to support journalists and local journalism, in your opinion?
I think people need to pay when they can. You know, there's lots of like Patreon supported local startups and things, and that's a great way to kind of put your money where your mouth is and say, like, I want more of this, I will pay for this. If it's not Patreon funded things, you know, subscriptions, it's reading, it's sharing stories, it's responding and engaging is a huge thing for local journalism. You know, when you read something in the Thai that you like, share it and tell your friends about it and get them to read it and get their friends to read it and that sort of thing, because that helps. And, you know, encouraging your local kind of local, provincial and federal politicians to support journalism, and ensuring that, you know, in your workplace, and this is directly about it, but I think it is connected, is just that advocating for fair treatment in your workplace and overall, because I think every industry needs that and journalism really needs it right now. We at HuffPost unionized 2 weeks before the closure. And because we did that, we are in such a better place. We have access to legal support. We have a lot more than we would have if we weren't unionized in dealing with this layoff. And so it's a bit of a convoluted thing to come around just saying that, like, supporting labor and supporting your workers and building that support for your media workers in your local community is important.
So do you have any advice for young and early career journalists in navigating the Canadian media landscape?
I mean, I'm doing it myself right now. It's something that, like, when I went to journalism school, even still, like in 2017, when I started my grad program here, I came, you know, back in Calgary, I worked at CJSW, the community radio station there. I worked at The Gauntlet, the student newspaper there. I was the editor-in-chief of The Gauntlet in 2016, 2017. And so I was like, I did a lot of journalism and I was like, I am doing it. But even then, when I went to journalism school, I was like, you know, maybe I'll still go into communications and, like, you know, nonprofit arts communications is what I'm really excited about. And in the progress of journalism school, I kind of found a niche and found some of the work I wanted to do and got some connections and kind of spiraled into me working at HuffPost. But even then, I still now am just like, you know, there's nothing wrong with taking a communications job, especially if it's something you're passionate about. And I think that that casualization I was talking about earlier with the industry is really great for people who have the stability or the ability to be super flexible and do what they want to do. And, you know, that's often people who are in their 20s and don't have kids and don't have, you know, aging relatives to care for and don't own a house and can move at the drop of a dime. That opens up a lot of doors and opportunities. And, you know, I have a friend who, you know, got a job opportunity in Regina, Saskatchewan, and had never been there and took it. And it was just like, yeah, it's a journalism job that I'm excited about. I'm going to move to Regina. And she has a great life there now, and she's really happy. So I think that taking those opportunities if you can and being flexible, but also not being mad at yourself if you can't, and knowing that you're still a journalist and you can still do journalism, but fit it into your life in ways where it's kind to you. Because, you know, they always say that work won't love you back. And journalism is such an industry that's driven by passion projects, and it's often very personal, especially when you're doing like personal reported work. Like it's your entire identity, but it won't love you back. It's still work, it's still a job. And it's okay to acknowledge that and find ways to try and make it work in amongst your life. And that's something I'm going through right now as I'm figuring out what I want to do next after HuffPost, is kind of saying like, I can still be a little flexible. Like I'm already in the last couple of weeks have lined up a bunch of projects that I'm really excited about. And it's like, I get to write a big feature about karaoke, and I get to, you know, produce this podcast, and I get to do this and this and this. It's like all those projects together for me personally aren't necessarily my long-term answer for when I want to, you know, be in my mid-30s and buy a house and get married and do all that stuff. But right now it works. And when it stops working, maybe I will take a communications job that I am excited about for, you know, an organization I'm excited about, and then still get to do the occasional project on the side. And so that's a really long-winded way to come around and just say that I think you can do journalism on your terms, and the industry sucks and hurts sometimes, but I think there's ways to work doing that kind of work in and around taking care of yourself too. And that's most important, and that you're not a failure for doing that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And do you think that journalism is becoming more gig-based? And I'm seeing a lot of like freelance journalists and that sort of thing. And is there a trend there? You know, is that a good thing? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's increasingly casualized, and it's very much a freelance industry, because then companies are realizing that they can do that. So that traditional model that you see in like the movies or whatever, or, like, even if you talk to a lot of like old school reporters, especially at newspapers, they'll be like, oh, well, I started as a paper boy in the 1970s. And then I, you know, was an assistant to the editor. And then I started writing. And then I moved from this beat to this beat. And now I've been here for 40 years. It's like that path of career doesn't exist anymore. Like, it just doesn't, because of the way that our media kind of works now. And, you know, maybe there's the odd person who will get to go along that path. But I think that we have to just acknowledge that the industry doesn't look like that, and we have to pave our own path. And again, there's room for opportunity in that, in the sense of you get to do what you want to do. You get to kind of find the niche that you fit into and the voice that you occupy. And some of the most successful freelance writers that you see on places like Twitter and stuff are people who have identified a beat, an area of coverage that is hugely lacking, there's an audience for, and that they are able to be the best at and do. And that works really well for them, but, you know, not everybody can do that full time. Some people can and some people can't, and it's okay to do it part time too. And that is the one benefit of this, you know, kind of messed up industry, is that you can do it on a part time basis while doing other stuff. You know, I freelanced a lot while I was in school, and it's like, that's cool. Like, you know, if I was in a different industry, like if I was a dentist, I couldn't like be a freelance dentist while I was in school. It's like, I couldn't just like be a dentist for like a couple hours every week. But with journalism, you kind of can. I mean, it's good to do it full time. It's good to carry beats, but you can also like pitch and write on your own schedule. And that's, you know, a nice thing sometimes.
Yeah. And so this is just like a personal question that popped up in my head. I'm kind of in that position of being like a student journalist and trying to get work and that sort of thing. I'm realizing that because it's not the traditional kind of workplace or work environment that, you know, we're taught to expect, it requires a lot of discipline and a lot of like engagement and reaching out. And like, what are your thoughts on that? Do you have any advice for that?
Yeah, I mean, I used to always say that when my classmates asked me about that, because I started freelancing right in my first year of my grad school here, pretty heavily. And I was like, all it is just like unearned self-confidence. And I was very lucky that I had, I mean, now it's earned, right? And at the time it was probably even earned, but I was very lucky that I had like a couple opportunities that turned into good stuff that have kind of just snowballed the rest of what I do. So, you know, in my first year of journalism school, I was out at a pub trivia night with some of my classmates And I was joking with my classmate Omri about how I wanted to write an article ranking ranch dressings. And we had just come from like our class where we were talking about how to pitch or whatever. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to pitch it. And I pulled out my laptop there at the bar and I was like, beep, boop, beep, boop, beep. And I wrote it and I was like, Vice, you will pay me to write about ranch dressings. And I just sent it to their like general like Canada advice.com email and like closed my laptop and did pub trivia. And I woke up the next morning and I had an email from the editor-in-chief at the time of Munchies, Vice's food vertical, saying like, hey, Mel, we like this pitch. We'll pay you $350 American to taste all these ranch dressings and write about it. Can you do it by Sunday? And I was like, yes, I can. And so I did it. And then I sent it in to her and she was like, that's great. Like, if you ever have other pitches, like send them directly to me. We have this connection now. Like, and if I have things I want to assign, I will give them to you. And that turned into me being able to write about half a dozen pieces over the next couple months for Vice and for Munchies. And then that I was able to mobilize when I pitched to other places and be like, well, I've written for Vice, so here you go. And it kind of spiraled and spiraled. And then when I got hired at HuffPost, my editor was like, oh, I love your ranch dressing article. And it's like, oh, it all came from like that pitch I did at like pub trivia night. And it's made me realize every time I send in a pitch now, it's kind of just like, well, if like first year university me at a pub trivia night writing up a 200-word pitch email can do it, then I can do it with this story too. I can do it with this story too. And, you know, in the last couple of weeks, I've been pitching a lot more, of course, because I'm back on the market. It's the same approach. And I'm just like, well, I believe this is a good story. I've done my research. I believe in my research. And I believe that you should pay me to do it. And a surprising amount of places say yes. If it's a good story and if you trust in your story and your research and, you know, what you have to share, it can really pay off. And then those things spiral so much. Like even now, the connections that I've been able to like go back to that I had even before working at HuffPost. You know, I had an editor I worked with while I was interning at the Globe and Mail who now works for The Walrus. And she reached out to me and was like, hey, do you want to write about this thing? I thought of you. And it's like, that's how I'm going to get published in The Walrus, which is like so cool to me still. And so I think just it is networking, but it's amazing how quickly that snowball can start to roll once you kind of take that first leap of what might feel like unearned self-confidence.
Yeah. And for a lot of people, you know, when we say journalism, the immediate thought is like politics or breaking news, but you know, we're noticing journalism topics are diversifying and I'm looking up like all the bylines that you've written and that sort of thing and seeing the just like sheer breadth of all the topics that you've written about. What do you think is the importance of covering these issues or these topics?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge, I'm very lucky. Again, my role at HuffPost, I was allowed to kind of write about whatever I wanted, which meant that I got to write about chicken sandwiches one week and then like white supremacy in my hometown the next week. And like, I was very grateful to have a platform to be able to do that kind of thing. There's like an audience for, you know, lifestyle content. There's an audience for cultural content. And, you know, speaking from our experience on the back end, that was some of the stuff that people read the most at HuffPost. Like by and far, our lifestyle section was lit. Like people love the Royals. People love Bridgerton. People like all these different things. Like, and I always, and I still do, I want to take my approach that's like journalism is a service. Like, you know, you're informing people, but you're also delighting them. You're engaging them. And those things all can happen at the same time in different ways. And there's nothing like lesser about fun coverage. And I definitely enjoyed doing the kind of fun stuff because it's like, if it's informing people and they're enjoying themselves, then that's important too.
I see. Well, that's the end of the questions that I have. Is there anything that I missed that you want to bring up?
Not really. Mostly just that when it comes, another piece of advice I really want to impart that I've learned in the last couple of weeks to young journalists is to value your work and know that a job isn't something you should like feel lucky about, if that makes sense. Like I have spent a lot of time looking back at the contract that I signed when I got hired back last year, not last year, 2 years ago. And there's like things in there about how, you know, I don't have benefits and I am not going to get severance and they could end my contract at any time and only give me 2 weeks notice. And it's like, I would if I and also like my pay, you know, I was told to just give a number, and like coming out of school, I was just like, oh, I'm gonna give a low number because I don't want them to be mad at me. And it's like, no, value yourself and ask questions about your contract and ask questions about how you're being treated fairly or unfairly, and talk to your coworkers about how much money you make and like all these kinds of things, because that's how journalism is going to change for the better, is if we have more conversations about fair treatment and labor and this whole union process and being a contractor and talking with my other coworkers and the solidarity that we've had together has really made me realize that if I could go back and tell 2019 Mel anything, it would be to ask questions about why your contract is the way it is. You know, demand a little better. You may not always get a yes, but if you don't ask those questions, then you won't ever. And that's how we're going to reshape media, because like, where are the future of media? Like the old people who are setting up these rules and expectations are going to be dead soon. So I think that we have to be able to create a fair, equitable media, and, you know, labor equity is such an important thing about that. And it all starts with where we value ourselves. I will never forget when I was hired into a job and I was asked, you know, for my starting salary, I remember asking my mentor, figure in my life, and I was like, what number should I give? Like, I have no idea what number I should give. And she's like, oh, you know, like 35. And I was like, $35,000. She's like, no, $35 an hour. And I was like, I don't deserve that much. And she's like, yes, you do. And then it's like, I wish I'd listened to her. Cause I didn't, I lowballed myself. Right. And so like, that's my biggest advice to young journalists, is don't lowball yourself. If you get a freelance contract and somebody says, oh, I can pay you $300 for this, say, hey, could you pay me $350? Like, you know, often they will say yes. And it doesn't hurt to ask those things. And the more we have those conversations, the better it'll get.
All right. So where can people find you going forward?
Yeah, I mean, the best place to find me is on twitter.com. I'm there constantly. Love to be scrolling. And that you can find me at Into the Melwoods. That's InTothemelwoods. And my website is melwoods.me. That's where you can find my kind of portfolio of work and stuff. But we all know that Twitter is the place to be.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for chatting with me today. This has been really illuminating. Thanks again.
If you are sick and have contracted COVID-19, the BC Centre for Disease Control recommends staying home from work, school, and away from other public places. If you must go out, avoid using any kind of public transportation, ride sharing, or taxis. Monitor your symptoms carefully. If your symptoms get worse, call your healthcare provider immediately. Get plenty of rest. Stay hydrated. If you have a medical appointment, call the healthcare provider ahead of time and tell them that you have or may have COVID-19. For medical emergencies, call 911 and notify the dispatch personnel that you have or may have COVID-19. Cover your coughs and sneezes. Wash your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds, or clean your hands with an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. As much as possible, stay in a specific room and away from other people in your home. Also, you should use a separate bathroom if available. If you need to be around other people in or outside of the home, always wear a face mask. Avoid sharing personal items with other people in your household, like dishes, towels, and bedding. Make sure all personal items are cleaned with general cleaning products after use. Clean all surfaces that are touched often, like counters, tabletops, and doorknobs. Use household cleaning sprays or wipes according to the label instructions. According to the BC Center for Disease Control, symptoms of coronavirus disease 2019, or COVID-19, may develop after 2 to 14 days of exposure. Common symptoms are fever, cough, and shortness of breath. Call your doctor if you are experiencing these symptoms. Emergency signs of COVID-19 are difficulty breathing or shortness of breath, persistent pain or pressure in chest, new confusion or inability to arouse, and bluish lips or face. This is not an exhaustive list. Go to the emergency room if you are experiencing these symptoms.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra Siam, Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, and the Skakuya, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustail.
Welcome back to On The Point, the news show right here on CITR 101.9 FM. You just listened to an interview with Mel Woods about the mass layoffs at Huffington Post and the implications for journalism here in Canada. Mel's been a contributor to CITR in the past, so you can go back and listen to her shows and her contributions over the past few years. So thank you so much again, Mel, for speaking to us on the show. So before we end the show, let's talk about everyone's favorite topic, COVID-19. That amazing small little thing. So let's talk about COVID-19 here in BC. I feel like I've said this so often in the past few months. So on March 25th, so a few days ago, we got the biggest spike of new cases this year since December 2nd was the last time we had above 800 cases, and we had, you know, around number 800. And a lot of that is concentrated in the lower mainland, especially Fraser Health, as was the case in the previous two waves of the pandemic. And, you know, Dr. Bonnie Henry said that, you know, we are in the third wave. You know, we're in it now, despite what people might say. And, well, obviously, it's not good. This comes at a time when the province is weirdly lessening restrictions. There's the 10-person outside bubble rule, which I guess actually does make a bit of sense considering the weather is getting better and outside outdoor transmission is sort of minimal. I mean, we saw that with the protests last summer, like the outdoor transmission of COVID-19 is not really, it's really only indoor environments like workplaces and stuff like that where we're seeing a lot of spread. But at the same time as they're allowing the outdoor meetings, they're also allowing indoor faith services, like religious services, for the few festivals that are coming up over the next month or so, like Easter, Passover, would be Ramadan, I think. Yes, it would be. And also Baisakhi. So they are allowing indoor services for that at the same time as they're like allowing the more safer outdoor meetings. So bit weird, let's just say that, from the province's standpoint. So there's an article in the TIE by Andrew Nikiforuk. We could have been largely free of the pandemic by now, but he sort of talks about, like, almost a month and a half ago, people were saying if we shut down now, we might have a chance of stopping the third wave, but we didn't. And here we are. And vaccination is slowly increasing, but not at the rate at which any sort of herd immunity can be gained before people will be in hospital. So my question to you all is to sort of just reflect a little. Do you think at any point the province or the government of Canada would have gone the way of Australia and New Zealand, or was it from the beginning set out to be this way of a year of sort of limbo? What do y'all think?
You know what's funny? I remember when, like, what was going down in China was happening and everyone was like, oh my god, like, authoritarian, like, they're shutting cities down, you know, they're quarantining people forcefully, whoa, like, you know, that was the whole thing. And people, and like, look, like, my friends in China are out clubbing right now, and I'm not saying clubbing is the point of life, but I'm saying, you know, it would, like, I haven't seen another human being, like, one of my friends in person for like almost a year. Like, I don't know. Like, I just feel like
There's a certain level of, like, chauvinism and just plain orientalism when it comes to this stuff, I think.
Yeah. When you take into account, like, the anti-maskers stuff and, like, the anti-masker movement that we have here in Canada, and it's, like, no wonder this has been going on for so long. Like, is anyone surprised? I'm not surprised.
I'm not surprised either. I think that from the beginning, there has been this sort of opposition to, I guess, sort of being inconvenienced. People don't want to have a more strict lockdown because they want to still be able to do everything that they can, even if that means that we'll be in this situation longer. And then there are people, an unfortunately large like portion of people who are just completely against taking even the most moderate of safety precautions, like wearing masks in public places, which is only going to exacerbate the problem for longer.
Yeah, I think it's like, it has a lot to do with like the individualist culture of like the West. And I'm not, you know, like trying to kind of entirely crap on the West, but I'm just saying, I think there is a larger question. COVID kind of just revealed the problems that we do have in our health system and, you know, in our government or in our society. And like, even after like COVID passed, like if things don't change structurally, we are still vulnerable to this kind of thing happening again and again.
Yeah, I just think that there's also just like a whole, nothing's uniform in this situation. Like the decision-making hasn't been necessarily consistent across the board. Attitudes of people in the public haven't been consistent across the board. There's like a lot of different dynamics at play. And I think that like a really effective and like, I guess, I always hesitate a lot when it comes to giving sort of like government authority to extend certain regulations. Like I have that natural kind of like, like in me, but like, I think in public health, that is a really strong argument. And it, like, obviously had we enforced that earlier, it would be easier to say how we would have had a better chance of it. But I think that like, I don't know. I think that there's an inconsistency on like individual willingness to adhere to like health protocols. And then there's also like a very legitimate balancing act with like keeping the economy afloat, and the government didn't prepare very adequately to do like proper injections for that either at the beginning. So like, I think that we were kind of always doomed because there wasn't like a very clear plan of attack to like acknowledge all these different concerns at the beginning when it would have been the most effective. And now I just kind of, I don't know how you control it at this point when there is just like this chronic mixed messaging, you know, like it's kind of like, I do understand the like logic behind allowing like for outdoor spaces, for example, but that I don't see that there's a lot of consistency in people adhering to health protocols in general. Yeah, it's kind of, it's like cool to say that you can have 10 people on outside now, and a lot of people, I'm sure, are now taking advantage of that and weren't before. But then, like, you walk around any part of Vancouver, and like restaurants have been packed since last year, you know. I don't know. It's just
Justin McElroy pointed this out on Twitter, which is we've never Dr. Bonnie Henry and the health ministry have always said that. We're not going to eliminate COVID-19. We've never been told why that's the case. Like, why not? Like, that's never been a question that anyone has ever asked. Because, because it's almost been seen as a given, and we still don't know why that's a given. Like, for months last year, BC had like 20 cases per day or something ridiculous like that. At that point, I think getting COVID completely out was not a certainty, but certainly a shot was there, you know, at that point. But as I said, we were under the assumption that we would never eliminate COVID from this province. And we still don't know why that is. And yeah, Maddie, you pretty much hit the nail on the head. The mixed messaging has been sort of really weird because you're getting at one extreme, you're getting the full libertarian, oh, we need to keep the restaurants open, otherwise they'll shut down. And the other end, you're like, oh, be more responsible. Like, it's like a traffic interchange, right? Like, you're only going to see the brightest signs. Like, are you going to see some, like, really small sign that's like, oh, yield? Or are you going to see the big, huge speed limit sign, you know? It just doesn't make any sense to me. But, you know, it is what it is. I think right now the bet by the public health office is that that vaccination is at such a clip, because I think that's been really ahead of schedule so far, that I think the bet right now is vaccination is going to overtake the virus. I don't know if it will, but we will see. We will see.
Isn't the like consensus now sort of that we're effectively just going to be dealing with this like a seasonal flu virus, like that this is, we're just hopefully going to get a lot better at how we handle it and it won't be so devastating and we won't have so many restrictions imposed. But like, I don't know, I feel like the general message I keep coming back to, at least, is that like this is here to stay, in the sense that like hopefully we just get more efficient at vaccination rollouts, but this is going to be kind of like the same old, like every year we got to buckle up from our COVID. Like, but
yeah, and the thing about that also is like vaccination may increase, but like Canada itself is dependent on imports from the US, from Europe, from India and all of that. So, you know, it doesn't help that all the domestic vaccine capabilities have completely been destroyed by privatization. So, yeah, maybe the profit motive doesn't help public health. Wow, what a conclusion we have just come to on the show.
Capitalism strikes again.
You're telling me that capitalism can have negative effects?
Truly. Oh my. Mind-boggling stuff.
It's just always the punchline.
Yeah. Does anyone else have anything to add? Or do you think we should call this?
Just end with everything is capitalism's fault always. And
yeah.
Yeah, let's do that. I think let's end with that. So yeah, Isa, take us away.
All right. So that's it for our show this week. You just listened to On The Point, CATR's news show. We'll be back next Saturday at 7 p.m. for more local news. Stay tuned for more great CATR programming.